From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's been a relatively calm day on Wall Street.
Finally, a relief to many after a wild week in global markets that has raised big concerns about China and the global economy. Joining us now with his perspective is Mohammed El-Erian. He's former CEO of the world's largest bond fund, PIMCO, chief economic advisor at Allianz SE, and he's also the chair of President Obama's Global Development Council. Mohammed El-Erian, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So what do you make of what we've seen in the stock market? How do you explain it over the last week or so?
So it's been an amazing roller coaster. The origin of this volatility were two things. One, the repricing of global growth prospects. This on evidence that China and other emerging economies are slowing down. And second, the repricing of this incredible faith that the markets have had in central banks. Because after all, if the source of the disruption is coming from outside the United States, from outside Europe, it's much harder for these central banks to be able to contain it. So that was the origin. And then the technicals took hold. What do I mean by technicals? I mean when people are forced to do things. So we saw people forced to sell because they were overlevered. And the result of that were massive volatility. And we've gone through an amazing roller coaster that has raised questions not only about the underlying strength of the markets, but also about the functioning of the markets.
And when you say that people were looking at central banks and what central banks could do, is that the only weapon in the American arsenal to keep our economy safe from whatever happens in China or the developing world?
Unfortunately, yes, in practice. Not in theory, in practice. In theory, we have a whole range of tools that have been underutilized. Tools to improve our productivity. Tools to make the labor market work better. But they've been paralyzed by political dysfunction. So the result of that is that the only game in town when it comes to policies has been the Federal Reserve. And the markets have been conditioned to believe that the Federal Reserve is their best friend. So as soon as you shake that confidence, what you get is a market repricing and you get incredible volatility.
So when do you expect the Fed will raise interest rates? And do you think it would be a mistake if the Fed raised interest rates next month as they had been planning to do?
So what's interesting is immediately after this disruption, we got indications out of the Fed from the president of the New York Fed, Bill Dudley, that the case for a September rate hike is, quote, less compelling. So immediately the Fed had the dovish remarks, and that helped stabilize the market along with stronger U.S. data. So I think the Fed will most likely wait. It won't go ahead in September, even though the domestic case to go forward is there. I think the international environment is simply too uncertain. And I don't think the Fed wants to fuel market instability at this point.
What about China? What should China be doing? They've tried a lot of things and some have worked better than others. But what would you think that they ought to do right now to try to stabilize things in that economy?
So there's two questions about China, the finance and the economics. On the finance side, China fell into the trap that we fell into with housing 10 years ago. We believed that it was a social priority to have higher and higher home ownership. So we promoted housing and we blew a bubble in the housing market. They've done exactly the same thing in the stock market. They believed that stock ownership was part of their journey to a market system. And they encouraged it and created a massive bubble in the stock market. So they're trying now to soft land that bubble. And as we discovered, it's not easy. It is not easy when you've sucked in so many people.
Should there be a fiscal stimulus, do you think, in China?
No, I don't think there should be a fiscal stimulus. If anything, they should continue their move towards market-based system where they rely less on the state. That's what's desirable. What's likely is that they're going to go backwards a little bit and go back to their comfort zone, which is try to take more control of both the financial sector and the economy.
One of the other things that happens when we have a roller coaster week like this on Wall Street is that people start to question a lot of things that they took for granted before, things that might be weaknesses in the U.S. economy. What do you think is the biggest weakness right now in the U.S. economy?
I think the biggest weakness is that we cannot get beyond third gear. So we will grow. We will grow at 2.5% to 3%. We will be the locomotive of global growth, but we will be a weak locomotive. We're not yet at economic liftoff. And we're capable of that. So my biggest concern is that we are not investing enough in our growth potential, and we risk lowering our growth potential.
So what should we be doing?
We should be going back to the use of the whole tools. And we have, in particular, three things we need to do. One is structural reforms to improve our productivity, and that speaks to infrastructure, fiscal reform. Two is we've got to better match the will and the wallet to spend. And that means we've got to look at and be honest about this enormous increase in inequality that's causing aggregate demand to be lower than what it should be. And finally, we have pockets of excessive indebtedness in the system. And we've got to deal with those pockets of excessive indebtedness. Otherwise, they're going to crush these segments.
When you say excessive indebtedness, are you talking about student loan debt?
Yes, that is something that we should be worried about today. We shouldn't wait for 5-10 years, because the last thing we want is a lost generation.
Do you have a solution for the student loan debt bubble?
Yeah, I do. I think you have to look at this and recognize that part of the educational process is contributing to social mobility, is contributing to productivity. And you've got to come up with ways to restructure this debt in an orderly fashion. It can be done. It just requires political commitment to solving this issue before it becomes too hard to solve.
Mohamed El-Erian, former CEO of PIMCO, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And now a pivot here. Over the next 2 weeks, the best tennis players in the world will be in New York competing in the U.S. Open. Most of the attention will be on Serena Williams as she attempts to complete a Grand Slam. She's already won the Australian Open, the French Open, and Wimbledon this year. But American fans will also be cheering a rising star on the men's side. Greg Eklund from Here and Now contributor KCUR in Kansas City reports.
On sun-drenched courts in Kansas City earlier this week, Jack Sock worked on his tennis game. The practice session was not far from Blue Valley North High School, where Sock played 80 matches in his 4 years there and never lost. Sock is preparing for the U.S. Open, and for the first time there, he's seeded number 28, the same number as his world ranking. Not too shabby for a 22-year-old.
Honestly, I just want to go and I just want to play, you know, my tennis, my style of tennis, and, you know, the things that I've been working on, you know, over the last few weeks to get ready and, you know, pretty much the whole summer to get ready for, you know, the mecca of the Open.
Jack Sock said he loves playing in Flushing Meadows. In 2010, he won the U.S. Open junior title there. A year later, he returned to play against his idol and fellow Nebraskan Andy Roddick at center court at Arthur Ashe Stadium.
You know, I thought I could do all right. Maybe didn't, you know, fully believe I could necessarily win. But, you know, definitely to play on, it was my first time on Arthur Ashe. So to play on, you know, the biggest court we have in tennis, you know, at the U.S. Open, our home slam against, you know, the guy I grew up watching. You know, it was pretty special on, you know, Friday night under the lights and on ESPN. So that was definitely a memory I'll never forget.
Jack's older brother, Eric, lives and teaches tennis in the Kansas City area. He remembered how inspiring Roddick was to him and Jack.
If this guy could be from Nebraska, from the Midwest, when people were saying you had to be from California and Texas and Florida, then why couldn't we do it?
Please welcome Jack Sock.
Following the Roddick style of developing a smashing forehand, Sock cracked the $1 billion mark in earnings last year and teamed with Canadian Vasek Pospisil to win the Wimbledon doubles title. But if you think that Jack's steady climb didn't have any, to borrow a tennis term, double faults, then you don't know Jack. Earlier this year, he finished 9 weeks of rehab from a surgery for a torn muscle in his pelvic area. During Jack's recovery, his brother Eric nearly died from a bacterial infection. After that experience, Eric says he noticed a change in Jack's outlook on everything.
It put tennis in more of a backseat. It can seem like the biggest thing before that happened, but then after something like a near-death experience happens to you, you kind of learn to put tennis in perspective.
This past April in Houston, with his family on hand, Jack Sock won his first professional singles title. He looked forward to celebrating.
You know, I have my brother here and my team, you know, that's been with me for a while now, through the ups and the downs, and to share a moment like this with them, you know, is going to be great.
No American man has won the U.S. Open since Roddick in 2003. Jack Sock knows that tennis fans long for those days of perennial American contenders.
seems like there's always been someone, you know, that's done it, and you know, right now maybe not at that point, but definitely we have a good group, I think, coming up.
Could Sock be the one to break through? The only American ranked ahead of him is John Isner, and he's 30. Tennis writer Nick McCarville says Sock has the game to do it.
The window of opportunity is certainly there.
But, as McCarville notes, the Big Four, Novak Djokovic, Roger Federer, Andy Murray, and Rafael Nadal, aren't ready to retire.
They look as motivated as ever, too.
Sock is motivated. It's his favorite time of the year. He'd like to stick around for the second week of the Open. To do that, he'll be playing the best in the world. Wait a minute. He is one of the best in the world. For Here and Now, I'm Greg Eklund in Kansas City.
See? It's my hair. We expect that from terrorists. Anchor babies, that's more related to Asians. Sit down. Sounds from the week in presidential politics.
Sounds just like him, Robin. I can't tell.
Sounds like our office. Let's cue the choir.
Here and now. 2016.
Joining us this week, Rick Klein, ABC News political director. He's in Washington. Hi, Rick.
Hi, good to be with you.
And Jose Diaz-Balart, Telemundo news anchor and host of The Rundown with Jose Diaz-Balart on MSNBC. Jose, welcome to you.
Thank you so much. Great being here.
And Jose, I want to start with you because this scene that has now become famous this week, we have to start with that, with Donald Trump saying this to Jorge Ramos, the popular anchor on Univision.
Excuse me. Sit down. You weren't called. Sit down. Sit down. Sit down. Go ahead. No, you don't. You haven't been called. Go back to Univision.
Jose, Trump's ratings actually went up in the new Quinnipiac University poll after that. Did this change the dynamic at all in the Republican nominating contest?
I don't think so. Among the people who are supporting Mr. Trump now and those who may be voting in the primaries in the upcoming months. But I think this is just in many ways, we live in two worlds. In the world of, you know, mainstream America see what happened with my colleague Jorge Ramos during a press conference. And, you know, there's reaction one way or another to that. But then there's also the world of people 54 million plus in this country that are Latino and that are concerned about issues that are being brought up and not seeing as that mainstream world is really kind of focused on the real issues behind the headlines.
Meaning what? And, what are we not seeing?
Well, I think you're not seeing – I think that by focusing on a spectacle – we are not focusing in on what are the actual positions of Mr. Trump, what's going on with undocumented population in the country, how they are seeing what conversations are being held in national headlines and in newspapers and television networks around the country. I mean, let me ask you, have we talked about the positions, the immigration positions of the candidates, other than what spectacles are occurring?
Well, you were absolutely right. And this was what Jorge was trying to ask. And, of course, Donald Trump has said he will have plans. He will have plans down the road. But
he released the plan.
Yeah. Well, but speaking of spectacles, Rick, an Hispanic DJ is calling Trump the man with the toupee. Trump read that from the paper, and then someone had an event yesterday confirmed that his hair is not a toupee. Rachel Maddow said last night, well, we don't think it's a toupee, but it's a weird comb over or words to that effect. And I'm thinking, with what Jose's saying, the other candidates must be pulling their hair out. They can't get a word in.
Yeah, we should check. We should check the top of Marco Rubio's head and Jeb Bush's head pretty quickly. This is how Trump plays the game, and it's a masterful game that Jose's point is he's able to kind of deflect a lot of the scrutiny that might come to a front runner because he knows how to feed the beast. He knows that will be the story of the day. He actually had a moment of, I thought, impressive candor earlier in the week when he said, "Look, one of my problems is that I'm on TV every day, so I have to say something different. I have to do something, maybe even a little bit outrageous." outrageous to get people to pay attention to me. And he is doing it, and he is feeding a crowd. I think he's also flirting with some of the worst elements of society and some of the coded language that he's used. And we've seen even white supremacist groups expressing some support. But there's no doubt that he is hitting a chord with a core of voters. That doesn't mean he wins an election, but it also doesn't mean that he just disappears.
No, and Rick, yeah. He also knows how to do TV.
Yeah. He does.
Better than anybody who's
ever. And he also knows how to tweet. And he knows how to just go into a state and fly in on Trump Force One and show up late at night and do a press conference and then tweet late at night and dominate another news cycle.
Well,
there really is no other part of the campaign right now on the Republican side. It is all Trump all the time.
But just to ask briefly, he's also pointing out, and Jeremy, you and I have talked about this, it is very difficult to listen to candidates once you've listened to Donald Trump because it underscores that candidates have become incredibly careful in how they speak. Politicians have, lawmakers have.
It's hard to watch somebody read off of a teleprompter after you watch Donald
right.
Trump say what he is, whatever's yeah. coming out of
Again,
his head.
He knows how to do TV.
Yeah.
It's a strange dynamic right now in our politics. We don't want our presidential candidates to sound, quote unquote, presidential. No one sounded or looked more presidential than Mitt Romney, and it didn't serve him that well. And I think that's the thing Hillary Clinton's running to on the Democratic side. Bernie Sanders, who goes out there and doesn't look anything like a traditional presidential candidate and doesn't sound like it with the fire he has, it's not uplifting, it's not optimistic, it's angry, but it seems real.
But it's not scripted.
Genuine.
It's not
that's
scripted.
And that's
yeah.
what Trump
and
does,
you know
too.
What? I think that we're also permitting the what the definition of leadership sounds like to have a different definition. I mean, does it, you know, would Winston Churchill, who had to fight, when he spoke publicly because of his fear and stuttering, Winston Churchill apparently couldn't be getting headlines. You know, FDR. Couldn't be getting headlines because of the timbre of his voice. Mm. And so bringing it back to the beginning, you know, spectacles and voice and hair pieces and prompter and how hypnotizing those things are, I think take away from the really important issues that should be being discussed.
Yeah.
You know, look, today on the Rundown, I mean, you know, 72 people died. In Austria, being transported migrants. There's a migrant crisis in Europe that are horrendous. Look what's going on in Libya.
Well, and actually, we just had a conversation about some of the economic problems in this country and the idea of a student loan debt bubble that nobody's talking about that could be a big problem. But let me just switch gears here because there has been some action on the Democratic side, and we do want to get to that. And that is Vice President Joe Biden considering a run at this point. Here he is in a conference call talking about the fact that he would need emotional fuel if he does decide to run.
If I were to announce to run, I have to be able to commit to all of you that I would be able to give it my whole heart and my whole soul. And right now, both are pretty well banged up, and we're trying to figure out that issue.
Rick, do you think he's going to run?
I think more likely this week than I did last week, although I still think there's an element of this being set up for him to be able to get out on top and get out gracefully. I think there's two different dynamics going on. One is the real frustration in the Democratic Party around Hillary Clinton and the party's de facto decision to anoint her as the nominee early on and the second guessing that goes on around that. And then there's the Biden piece of it and his legacy and his own personal journey and the harrowing and awful personal toll that he's had to endure emotionally over the last couple of months. He has to decide. It's gut check time for him. That, to me, is a different box to check than the one about Hillary. So yeah. I think it's in his mind. There's a lot of aides that are doing a lot of things to try to make it easy for him to be able to make that decision as he's earned a right to be able to do on his own terms.
Well, the Quinnipiac poll yesterday showed him beating Trump, Bush, Rubio by many more points than Hillary Clinton would. So there was that for his followers. But
although it's always easier to run before you
run. Yes, right.
Exactly right.
He hasn't been out there to be beaten up yet. But Hillary Clinton is getting kind of beaten up by Republicans for this new line that she tried out against them yesterday. Let's listen.
Extreme views about women. We expect that from some of the terrorist groups. We expect that from people who don't want to live in the modern world. But it's a little hard to take coming from Republicans who want to be the president of the United States, yet they espouse out-of-date and out-of-touch policies.
Jose, weigh in on that.
I don't think it's ever good to compare those in a democratic process to terrorist groups, totalitarian regimes, bloodthirsty dictators, people who abuse other people. I think that it's far better discourse to criticize those on policy issues and on things that you may be diametrically opposed to them on the merits of it. But I think when you start comparing and contrasting to people that are just horrendous, either that are in the present time or in the past, I think that it does no benefit to the democratic process and to the rule of law that this country is based on. I think that democracy is a beautiful thing. It's a rough and tumble thing many times, but to compare and contrast to those that have no concept of democracy and that have the solution being killing human beings, to compare that, I think, is never a positive.
Okay, let's just take a brief moment with each of you to ask what we're missing this week. What have we, while we focus on Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, what should we be talking about this week, Jose?
Well, I think Guatemala. I think what's
In the presidential race.
But I've got to tell you something. Let me tell you something. Because what's going on, the crisis that's going on in Guatemala today, the vice president of that country is in jail. Imagine that. And the president is a hair away from possibly being taken to court. And remember last summer when the unaccompanied minors crisis caught all our attention all of a sudden?
And that's what they were running from. Yeah,
that's exactly right.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's always good to draw a wider lens when you're thinking about what's important for us in the United States and look at our neighbors to the south and further away.
And Rick?
I'm going to stick with foreign policy. And on the political end of things, we're starting to see with the Iran deal, also with the China visit next month, the Republicans begin to position themselves as a foil to President Obama on foreign policy. We know that he's focusing his final year and a half on foreign policy. And I think that could dominate the 2016 discussion a lot more than Trump's hair in the weeks to come.
Rick Klein, ABC News political director, Jose Diaz-Balart, news anchor at Telemundo. And he hosts The Rundown with Jose Diaz-Balart on MSNBC. Well, pleasure for us. We'll have you both back. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Because as it turns out, there's a lot more to cover before the 2016.
And many more weeks to go.
Right. And it's Friday when we look at what's happening on social media, or today, what's not happening anymore. Politroops, the website from the Sunlight Foundation that kept track of tweets that politicians deleted, is gone. It used a tool Twitter created to alert people of deletes so that they could delete retweets or screensavers. But instead, Politroops aggregated and posted them, and now Twitter won't let them use that tool. Margarita Noriega of Vox is covering this. Margarita, give us an example of the kinds of tweets that Politroops had been posting.
One sort of famous example is in the case of Senator Scott Brown, who tweeted, funnily, in 2013, a very interesting typo of the word whatever. He actually tweeted "buck whatever," spelled BQ, and then the word
H-A.
Whatever.
Yeah, it was
exactly.
It's a weird thing.
Yeah, it's a very weird thing. And, you know, that type of thing is just funny.
Well, of course, he's the former Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown. And he'd been in a back and forth of tweets with other Twitter users. And he'd been saying to some of them, whatever, you know, they'd been criticizing him or you're brilliant. You know, they say never get engaged, but he did. And then later this buck whatever came out. He said it was a pocket tweet.
He did say it was a pocket tweet. Others wondered, given the late hour, if he had a couple of drinks, which, of course, he denied.
So this is the kind of thing that he had tried to delete, but it shows up on Politroops.
Exactly. And in this case, it's perhaps an example of something a little more mundane. But when you think about the public record and just in terms of understanding knowledge about what people making money from the taxpayer dollar are doing, right? It becomes a little more important when someone deletes a tweet, say, about going to a fundraiser or spending time with a constituent. It's these types of things that the Sunlight Foundation and folks involved with Politroops wanted to record.
Well, and you also write about concern about a slippery slope.
Yeah, so I try not to write about a slippery slope, but it is easy to imagine a world in which if Twitter wants to make sure that everyone takes down content that's been deleted, what is our concept of memory on the internet? So should we have everything deleted from the past that we don't like, whether or not we work for taxpayer dollars? And this argument and this idea really applies to a much broader scope than just Twitter. It really applies to the way companies use our data all the time.
Well, and as you point out, in Europe, people have the right to be forgotten. On Google, you can can ask that something about you be erased from Google's search engine. You know, people would say, look, there's things I don't want out there. There's a tweet that I, you know, didn't mean to send. I, you know, want to take it back. The argument is they have the right to do that. You say, what if that tweet made its way into song lyrics? How far will Twitter go to pull things back?
Exactly. So Twitter now has the same amount of monthly active users as there are roughly Americans. It is interesting to think about the idea that Twitter's influence in the news and the way that we record information could ripple out to other parts of the internet, whether that's your favorite social media site or that's just the internet in general. The right to be forgotten in Europe could at any time be considered by our own local governments or federal governments here in the U.S., and it's something we need to think about.
Maybe just the way to think about it is if you say something near an open microphone, you can't take that back. It's out there. Margarita Noriega, an editor at Vox, thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin.
We all know how hard it can be to find parking, but imagine how much harder it would be if you were trying to park a huge truck while on a long journey to deliver goods. According to a study out this month from the Federal Highway Administration, there's a big lack of safe parking for truck drivers, and it's a national safety concern. Joining us from Dallas is Desiree Wood, president of the Real Women in Trucking organization and a trucker herself. Desiree, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much for having me.
And is that a surprise to you, the idea that there are big parking shortages for truckers in almost every state?
No, not at all. These studies have been going on since 1999, and nobody's done anything about it. They've just ignored it. We completed our own driver survey that was done in 2013, published on my website. We already know that this was a crisis. It's just nobody's wanted to do anything about it.
Well, give us a sense of what it means for you as a trucker. Give me an example of what it's like to drive around and decide it's time to take a rest and not be able to find a place to do that.
It's very stressful. It's scary. I just published some open comments from drivers, and some people say, you mean men truckers are afraid? Yes. When you have driven all day and you are trying to find somewhere to stop this very large vehicle and you have no options, you have someplace that's filled with crime, you have a on-ramp, you have a supermarket shopping center, and you have to hope that the local law enforcement doesn't come and bang on your door and run you out when you're exhausted and you're over the federal requirement to even move the truck, and they're like, you have to get out. You know, you get treated like you're a criminal. Hmm.
And of course, we see that the places where it looks like the problems are the worst are in some of the big population centers along I-95 on the East Coast, around Chicago on I-70, and on I-5 out in California.
Yes, obviously where there's more people. You know, nobody wants to have a truck stop in their backyard. And that's unfortunate that the public does not recognize that these are people that serve them every day. They should be seen as service people. Being a truck driver is as honorable a job as being a firefighter. They serve our country, and then at the end of the day, they're treated like second-class citizens. Go fend for yourself and left to be a sitting duck. And I think that's really sad. And so awareness and education is a huge part of this campaign that Hope Rivenberg has led, to understand that these people need a safe place to park. And then when they get to park there, don't allow crime to come banging on their door.
Well, and when you mention Hope Rivenberg, you're talking about the wife of Jason Rivenberg, a trucker that was robbed and killed in 2009 while he was parked in an abandoned gas station in South Carolina. He was told he wasn't allowed to park in the lot of a grocery store before delivering milk there.
Yeah, and that's very common, especially with grocery warehouses. They have a very strict appointment time. You better be there on time or you could be fined or you could be sent away to come back another time. And to do that, you've got to really meet some tight schedules. If you hit weather or traffic, it could just throw everything off. So you really want to get as close to that location as possible. And then when you get there and you're like, hey, I'm here. And they're like, well, you're 2 hours early, so go away and come back.
Hmm.
Okay, well, where do I go? They don't know. They don't care. They don't want to be involved and you're not allowed on their property. So you try to get, and that's what Jason did, try to get as close as possible. And he parked in an abandoned gas station and he had this crime committed against him, which ended his life.
So whose responsibility should it be to create safe places for truckers to park?
Well, in my opinion, the shippers and the receivers and the brokers who are dictating the scheduled times, if they're saying you got to be here right now and then we might not even be ready to unload you or load you. We might keep you here on our property for 4-10 hours and then your federal hours of service have expired. And then they say, well, we're done with you, so leave. Well, now I'm in violation. We don't care. You have to leave. No, this is not acceptable at all. These shippers and receivers need to be part of this conversation, and that's been suggested in previous studies as well. If they don't want the truckers to stay on their property, they should create a community bullpen that has bathroom facilities and is got some security and some lighting then, because they're basically putting these trucks out and having them be sitting ducks. And then the local community people, they don't really realize, well, why are all these trucks are on the side of the ramp around here? And I'm trying to get to work and I've got to, you know, navigate all of the around these nuisance vehicles when I'm trying to get on the on-ramp or the off-ramp or what have you. So a lot of it's education. And then the other thing is the rest areas. You know, that's a place that you can get in and get out of quickly and save some time. There's a lot of controversy about letting some privatization happen. It's a very neglected industry, and this area right here is super important. As these trucks are getting longer and wider, and they want to put more freight on them, and they sort of want to put the cart before the horse. You know, they want more frosting on their cake, this industry, before they even bought the cake mix.
Hmm. And when you mentioned those federal hours, this is a change that took effect 2 years ago that requires truckers to take 30-minute breaks after 8 hours of driving and to stop for a longer period after 11 hours.
Well, the 30-minute break is – it's really a joke because my 30-minute break – if I'm coming up on a 30-minute break and I go to get off of the highway to go to a truck stop, say, to take my 30-minute break – I'm going to plan it around when I have to fuel. That takes 15 minutes, and I'm going to use the bathroom. And these truck stops are – they're historically understaffed. So should I decide to buy a bag of chips in there, I'm going to be in a super long line, and it's going to take me 30 minutes to 45 minutes to get back out on the highway and drive again. That's my 30-minute break. That's how – that's the reality of it. Drivers can drive 11 hours a day, and then they need to stop the truck for 10 hours to sleep. A lot of rest areas have in the past had a two-hour. You can only stop here for 2 hours, and then they'll try to run you off. No, this is the federal law. I got to stay put for 10 hours. A lot of local law enforcement, they don't want to – be educated enough on this. They want to have a sort of a power struggle. You know, I'm in charge here and you're going to move. Local communities don't realize when this truck is stopped and in break, it must be left undisturbed. So if it's in your way, where can we put it where it can be resting? Because I know you don't want a tired trucker on the road, do you?
Well, exactly. And we've seen what happens with that, too. So so do you think anything will change here? Do you think that this survey and others will finally cause lawmakers to take this seriously and make some changes?
I sure hope so. You know, Hope went to a lot of these organizations when she started all of this. And they were like, you know, good luck with that. And now, you know, it was social media has really been the thing where drivers could get on there and have a voice and raise all kinds of holy heck on Twitter and Facebook and get some people to listen to us, people that could have just picked up the phone to somebody that had an office across the road from them and say, hey, we got a problem. Let's do this. This is a good thing. And we keep pushing the paper around the desk. So there's some really simple solutions. Build more truck parking. Make sure the trucks fit. make sure that it's designed properly, make sure it's managed properly so that RVs and recreational vehicles and things like that aren't parking in the truck parking, and have some lighting, some security, keep the crime out, keep the crime away from these people. It's really simple local communities and states can do to be a partner in this, you know.
That's Desiree Wood, who's president of the Real Women in Trucking organization and a trucker herself, joining us from Dallas. Desiree, thank you.
Thank you.
As we remember Hurricane Katrina 10 years later, we want to take a moment now to talk about the incredible journalism that was done during that storm. Journalists weren't just journalists. They became first responders in a way. The New Orleans Times-Picayune and the Sun-Herald in Biloxi, Gulfport, Mississippi were both awarded Pulitzer Prizes in 2006 for providing a lifeline for devastated readers. The national media got involved as well. Here's Anderson Cooper talking with former Louisiana Senator Mary Landrieu on CNN days after the storm, and she asked him if he'd heard about a bill that was about to be signed.
Excuse me, Senator, I'm sorry for interrupting. I haven't heard that because for the last 4 days, I've been seeing dead bodies in the streets here in Mississippi, and to listen to politicians thanking each other and complimenting each other, it just, you know, it kind of cuts them the wrong way right now, because literally there was a body on the streets of this town yesterday being eaten by rats because this woman had been laying in the street for 48 hours, and there's not enough facilities to take her up. Do you get the anger that is out here?
Wow. Joining us now is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, you hear in that, you wonder how some of the journalists, TV, radio, print, were even able to get to these places where clearly the authorities were not.
Well, you know, these are for local reporters in particular. These are their homes. These are their families, neighbors, friends, loved ones. You know, I went down afterward a year after to the Times-Picayune newsroom, and they showed me, you know, where the water was lapping up and surrounding their own building. You know, this was something that affected them directly. They went out in canoes. They fanned out. They some evacuated, some hunkered down, and they lived through this themselves. So it was emotional. I think your term first responders is very accurate. And, you know, national reporters went down, descended as well to try to help people make sense of this, you know, city that plays an outside importance in some ways in our nation's psyche.
And full disclosure, I, along with a former colleague, Susan Feeney, helped to organize some fundraisers for the journalists at the Times-Picayune whose homes were destroyed as they stayed in New Orleans to cover the storm. And it just struck me that without them, the government wouldn't even have known about what was going on in some areas.
Well, you know, people turned to the newspaper for information and trusted it in part because they had such conflicting, contradictory, and inflated accounts from public officials and authorities themselves. The Times-Picayune played an outsized role. It took them several days after the storm's really powerful hit on New Orleans knocked them out of publication, but they were posting things in kind of a fairly primitive blog form that we would now recognize as something of a Tumblr scroll, where each little update, each piece of information they would put up there, and it would just continue. You could keep finding it if you scrolled farther down. And they were providing a mix of news and reporting, but also public service where people could get food or supplies. Yeah. If somebody was missing a loved one and looking for them, they tried to post information there as well. In addition, on local radio, the folks banded together in an impressive way to provide news and would corner public officials at this emergency operations center where they could just – they had a mic in a corner. They would take all these different people, whether they be sports anchors, gospel anchors.
Well, or the mayor. Or we've got a piece of tape here from local radio. This is from WWLAM 3 days after the storm, and Garland Robinette talking with Mayor Ray Nagin.
People are dying. They don't have homes. The city of New Orleans will never be the same.
We're both pretty speechless here.
Yeah, I don't know what's...
I gotta go.
Okay. Keep in touch. Keep in touch.
Okay. Can we take a break?
David, as you hear the emotion in the voice there, does it change the way that something is covered when the journalists themselves end up being part of the story and showing their emotions? It certainly draws more attention.
inescapably. That exchange is not being done for attention.
No, of course not. But it does bring more attention to the story when it does happen like that.
It's intimate. In some ways, it's reassuring to people to know that journalists are going through this with them. And it was heroic. This low wattage radio station brought in people from all these other stations to do this with them, well out of their expertise. They were using their broadcast knowledge and their just voice and their hearts to do this. I must say that the media on a national level also, Anderson Cooper, who we heard from, Brian Williams, then the chief anchor for NBC, really brought out some say an advocacy voice, but emotions as well. The media also participated in disseminating a lot of myths, a lot of wrong information. And I think it's, we're able to keep in our mind two thoughts at the same time, which is I think they actually performed in many ways admirably, trying to perform to serve information, particularly the local outfits working just beyond snapping point to do so. And at the same time, spread a lot of misinformation, a lot of third, fourth, fifth, sixth hand reports, notions that there were rapes of children in the convention center, never proven, never shown. That there was a claim, I think, in St. Bernard Parish, there were 300 bodies stacked up in a school there.
Right.
That turned not to be the case.
Well, things that you would probably hear if this storm were to happen now, 10 years later, of course, it's a very different media landscape. And we've got Twitter, and there would be tweets that were correct about what's going on, and there would be tweets that were incorrect. Mm-hmm. But we're going to have to leave it there. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, thank you so much.
You bet.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.